hand. She touched and treated me like I was her boyfriend, and I loved it. About an hour after we got there, some cops walk in with a guy I'd never seen before. These were small-town cops, fat, stupid assholes with mustaches and beer guts and guns and badges. I knew them, and they knew me. In the years I had spent in that town, I had openly taunted them and had dared them to try and catch me on something, which they never had. Now they had this new guy, and they marched up to me full of bullshit cop bravado, and they pulled out a warrant, and they said I had to come down to the station with them to answer some questions. They said there was another team of people searching my house with dogs. I laughed and told them to get the fuck out of my face, and the new guy pulled out his badge and said, "Son, I am with the FBI, and your number is up." And he grabbed me and hauled my ass out of there. He did it right in front of her, and did it right in front of her friends. I was fucking humiliated. After years of being in love with this girl, I was sure she would never speak to me again. The car ride down to the station was bullshit. I sang the national anthem at the top of my lungs, and in between renditions asked the cops when we were stopping for pie. The questioning session was even more ridiculous. The FBI agent kept asking me about my trips to Brazil, which had nothing to do with drugs, and about who I knew in South America, and I just alternated answers. "I won't speak until I have a lawyer. Your mustache makes you look like a fucking idiot." Eventually, the search team came back, and they hadn't found anything at my house because there was nothing left to find, and they had to let me go. I walked out. And on my way, I told every cop I saw to go fuck himself. Lily laughs.
"What did they say?"
A couple ignored me. A couple said it back. One threw a cup of coffee at me.
"Did it hit you?"
"No."
"Did you go see the girl?"
"When they came out the front door, she was sitting on the bumper of her car waiting for me."
"She upset?"
I nod. "Yeah, she had been crying."
"What did you do?"
She was smoking a cigarette and staring at the ground, and she didn't see me, so I walked up to her, and I asked her if she was waiting for someone. She looked up and smiled, and threw her arms around me and cried on my shoulder. When she was done crying, she asked if I was in trouble, and I said no, and she asked if I was all right, and I said yes. Then she looked me in the eye, and she took my hand, and she said, "If we're going to be together, I have to be with the person I know, not the person I have heard stories about. I can't deal with police and the drugs and the drinking and whatever else you've got going on, so make up your mind right now about who you're going to be." I smiled and I said, "I want to be the kind of person that you would be proud to be with. I'm going to do everything I can to be that person. If you can deal with that, just nod. If you can't, just walk away. If you nod, though, I'm going to kiss you right here and right now and right on the lips, and that kiss will be my pledge to you that I'll make myself better." She stared at me and she smiled, and she nodded, and I took my hands from her hands, and I put them on her cheeks, and I kissed her, and for a while at least, that kiss changed me. And for a while at least, she and I were in love.
"And then you fucked it up?"
"Yeah."
"What did you do?"
"I don't want to talk about that right now."
"Why?"
"Just don't."
"What do you want to do?"
"I want to kiss you again."
"Because you're thinking of her?"
"No,
because I'm thinking of you."
Lily smiles and she lets go of my hands, and she puts her arms around me and she holds me. And she softly kisses the skin of my neck. I feel safe in her arms, safe like I have never felt, and the calm and the power of the calm is still with me. She raises her head slightly, she raises it, and she softly kisses my lips and pulls me tighter. I have never felt so safe and so calm in her arms, kissing her. She lets go and she pulls away. She smiles at me and she runs one of her hands down one of my cheeks.
I wish I was her.
Why?
Because it would be nice to have someone feel that way about me.
You've never been in love?
Not even close.
And no one's ever been in love with you?
Men always want to fuck me, but no one has ever loved me.
I don't believe that.
It's true. I don't believe it.
She stares at me.
It's true.
I stare back. If it makes any difference, I don't want to fuck you. She laughs.
Thanks.
I think you're beautiful, but I wouldn't fuck you because when we were done, I wouldn't want you to feel fucked. I would try to make love to you, and I would probably be clumsy and awkward, but when it was over, I would want you to feel loved. She smiles.
Thank you, James.
I smile. Thank you, Lily. We smile at each other, and we look into each other's eyes, and we speak to each other with the silence that lies between us. It is strong, safe, and calm. The silence between us. Lily looks down at her watch.
It's getting late.
Yeah.
Meet me tomorrow?
I don't know.
Why?
I don't know if I can.
You getting scared?
A little, but that's not why I can't meet you.
What's the reason?
My parents are coming here tomorrow. I have to do the family program with them, and I don't know how much free time I have.
You excited?
No.
Why?
I don't get along with my parents, and I don't want them here.
Adjust your attitude, boy.
I laugh. What?
I said adjust your attitude, boy.
What are you talking about?
You're fucking lucky to have parents. You're even luckier if they actually love you. If they're willing to take time out of their lives to come here to try and understand why you are the way you are and to try to learn to help you, then you hit the fucking jackpot. Be cool to them and try to understand how they must feel having to come here to see you and how upset they must be about it.
They've always been upset with me. That's part of the problem.
From what I know about you, they probably had every right to be.
Maybe.
Maybe nothing. Adjust your fucking attitude and try to be cool with them and remember how lucky you are to even have them.
I look down, stare at the ground, nod.
She grabs my chin and she lifts my face back to hers. I want you to say, okay, dearest Lily, I'll try to be cool to my parents.
I smile. You getting tough with me? She nods.
I'm a badass, boy. Don't fucking forget it.
I laugh.
Okay, dearest Lily, I'll try to be cool to my parents.
She laughs.
Thank you.
I stare at her, let my smile fade. It won't fade inside. I have never felt so safe or calm. This hard, damaged, drug-addicted, badass girl sitting in front of me with her black hair and her braided pigtails, and her clear water blue eyes and her scars, the scars on her wrist, naked beneath a plastic watch, makes me feel safe and calm. I want to see you tomorrow, but I don't know what this thing with my parents is going to be like. When you go to lunch, sit so you can see into the men's section. If my back is turned, I can't meet you. If I'm facing you, I can meet you. And the number of plates on my tray is the time I'll be here.
What if you can't come till midnight?
Then I'm going to look like a fucking idiot. She laughs.
Kiss me before you go.
I lean in and I kiss her. Kiss her lips soft and wet and warm. I put my arms around her and I hold her tight, this little badass friend of mine. She pulls away and we stand. She speaks.
Have a good night.
I will. She turns and she starts to walk away. I speak. Lily. She stops and she looks back.
What? I'll miss you.
She smiles.
Good.
She turns back and she disappears into the green. I turn the opposite way and I push through and I come out on a trail and I walk slowly back. I feel safe and calm. And I want this feeling for as long as I can have it. I stop outside the glass door to the unit. I stare through the glass at the men. They are not safe or calm. They are watching television, playing cards, smoking cigarettes, and drinking coffee. They are talking shit and telling stories. They are neither safe nor calm. Addictions need fuel. They're filling up. I know I can't keep feeling this way. It will disappear sooner or later. I choose sooner, and I open the door, and I step inside the unit. I walk to my room. The door is closed, so I knock softly. There is no reply. I open the door, and I step inside. Miles is sitting on his bed. His face is in his hands, and he is weeping. I am sure that he heard me come in, but he doesn't acknowledge me. His face is in his hands, and he is weeping. I step back the way I came, and I shut the door. I am in the hall, and the lights are on. And the walls are white, and I wish they were blue, clear water blue. I walk to the dining hall. I am early, and it is empty. I get a tray and a plate of fish sticks and tartar sauce, and I choose a table, and I sit down. I start eating. I eat slowly. The fish sticks are warm and soggy. The breaded crust around them tastes like wet sand. With each bite, a part of me flares, and once more, once the whole stick at once, it screams and begs for 500 sticks at once, sandy crust and all. It doesn't matter how disgusting they are, I just fucking want them. I sit, and I breathe, and I clench my jaw. I stare straight ahead. One bite at a time. Hold on. One bite at a time. It's not that hard. One bite at a time. They're fucking fish sticks. Just hold on. I finish eating. Men start trickling in. They do not sit with me. I want more food, a lot more food, but I don't get up from the table. I just sit and I hold, sit and hold, sit and hold. I am aware that the battle I am fighting is a petty one, but I am also aware that in order to win that which is great, you must first win that which is small. An addiction is an addiction, and a fight is a fight. The same principles apply. Just hold on. I see Leonard coming off the line. He has beef and noodles instead of fish sticks. He smiles and he nods at me, and he comes to my table and sits down. He is freshly showered, and his hair is wet, and his face is flushed. How you doing, kid? I'm good. You? I've had a very good day. Why? None of your business. Why? Stop asking why. Can I ask what? Maybe. What do you do for a living, Leonard? He laughs. You know what I do, kid. I want to hear you say it. Somebody been talking to you? Yeah. They talked to me, too. What did they say? They said they didn't want me being a bad influence on you. I told them you weren't. Thank you. What do you do for a living, Leonard? You already know, kid. I want to hear you say it. Leonard takes a bite of his beef and noodles. He smiles while he chews. I'm the West Coast director of a large Italian finance firm. I laugh. Need to know anything else? No. That's probably best. Yeah. You see your girlfriend today? Yeah. You admit she's your girlfriend now? Sort of. She good? Yeah, she is. You like her? I do. You love her? In a way. Watch your step, kid. They asked me about her, too. How would they know about her? They know everything. How? It's not hard to know things if you want to know them. I guess. You know what I think? What? I think love is a rare thing in the world. If you think you can have it with this girl, then fuck whoever tries to stop you and fuck their rules. Take the risk and do whatever you can do and try not to get caught. If you do get caught, do it again. I laugh. You're being a bad influence, Leonard. He smiles. No, I'm not, kid. I smile. Leonard smiles. We eat silently. Nobody sits with us. We finish dinner and we walk to the lecture and we sit with Ed and Ted and Maddie in the same seats we always sit in with them. We play cards and the results are back to normal. Leonard wins, everyone else loses. The stakes are small enough so that no one cares. Time is slow in here. The game just helps the time go by faster. We know Leonard will split the winnings when we're done. Win a couple bucks, lose a couple bucks. Ignore whoever is on the stage. I don't even bother looking anymore. The lecture ends and we walk back to the unit. I get a cup of coffee and I find a place on one of the couches among several other men, and I watch TV. There is a show on about a group of doctors working in an inner-city emergency room. One of the stories on the show is about a female heroin addict who has come to the hospital after an overdose. She is a beautiful young woman whose body is absent of any bruises, scars, or track marks. She wears dirty clothes that are ragged in a glamorous way. She cries whenever anyone talks to her, and there are large black bags under her eyes, though her crying is obviously fake, and the bags under her eyes are a different size each time we see her. She started smoking pot on a lark, met a man, and fell in love, and the man happened to be a heroin dealer who got her hooked on his product. Now she can't quit, and after loading up a particularly large dose, she has woken up and found herself in the ER, which is the only part of the story which is even reasonably authentic. She refuses to accept any blame for the situation. She yells, "It wasn't my fault!" over and over and over. As we watch the show, some of the men boo when the girl makes her appearances. A couple of them clap and laugh. One of them grunts and throws his shoe at the TV, which he then retrieves and holds cocked in his hand until she shows up again. If he had a gun, he would probably blow the television to pieces. As the episode drags on, the girl confronts her problems with the help of a handsome young doctor in the ER. He eases her off the junk. He gets her an AA. He lets her stay in his apartment, comforts her when she cries, brings home special nutritional juices for her each night after work. They fall in love, and after an emotional candlelit dinner, they have glorious, romantic, and multi-orgasmic sex. By the time the show is finished, she is all better. She has kicked her habit completely, and she has a new life. It closes with a shot of her and the doctor walking down the street with a young golden retriever frolicking at their side. If I could, I would hunt down the creators of this utter bullshit fantasy fairy tale piece of crap, and I would lock them in a room and feed them drugs until they were profoundly and chronically addicted to them. Then I would overdose them, drive them to the nearest inner-city ER, and I would drop them off at the door, right next to the homeless guys with knives, the addicts with AIDS, and the cops, and the ambulance driver smoking cigarettes. I'd leave them there for a couple of days, and then I'd come back and check on them. If they were still alive or still around, which would be highly unlikely, I'd ask them if their experience has in any way whatsoever resembled the experience they presented to the public. I'd ask them if they were through detoxification and if they were feeling good. I'd ask them if they had been to their first AA meeting, and if they had found new jobs, and if they had found new apartments. I'd ask them if they had fallen in love over a candlelit dinner, and if they had the best sex of their lives. I'd ask them if they had purchased their new golden retrievers. After I received their answers, "No, no, no, please, what do I do now? No, fuck me, I'm fucked, no, please help me, no, 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 no," I'd ask them how they were going to present addiction to the public in the future. I'd ask them if they were going to romanticize it, glorify it, make light of it, or portray it in a way that is wholly inaccurate. "No, no, no, please, what do I do now? No, fuck me, I'm fucked. No, please, help me. No, 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 no." That's what I thought, you motherfuckers. No. After the show, I stand and I walk to my room. I have not seen Miles since I saw him earlier. And I stop and I put my ear to the door before I reach to open it. I hear weeping, soft, quiet sobs, mumbled words spoken to the air, a fist pounding a pillow. I would like to be in my bed, under the covers and warm, but I do not want to disturb him. So I let go of the door, and I walk back to the unit. I get another cup of coffee, and I go back to the couch. The lower level is empty, but for me and two men. I don't know them, and I don't speak to them. There is a talk show on the TV, and a movie star is talking about his love for automobile racing, and the host of the show pretends to be interested in what he's saying. He smiles, nods when he needs to nod, accentuates the movie star's remarks with witty responses. The audience of the show is enraptured, and though I know the show is idiotic, I am enraptured as well. I am an alcoholic and a drug addict. I need fuel. I'll take what I can get. I drink another cup of coffee, watch another talk show, fade in and out of sleep. Coffee doesn't affect me anymore, and the TV is a narcotic. Its dull flicker feeding me, filling me, killing me, keeping me, holding me here, and giving me something on which to focus. The two men on the couches next to me are both sound asleep. One of them is twitching and moaning, softly crying a word all too common. He cries, "Stop, stop, stop." The other is snoring and still. I'd think he was dead but for the noise. I fade in and out. The TV is a narcotic. In and out. In, out. In, out. A man selling hair growth products screams, "Buy, buy, buy, it'll grow, grow, grow. The head of hair that you've always dreamed of, I can give it to you if you buy, 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 it'll grow, grow, grow." He is standing on a beach. There are beautiful blondes on each of his arms. He is wearing a cheap suit. I turn him off. I walk to my room, and I open the door. I step inside. Miles is awake, sitting on his bed. He is reading the Bible. He nods to me, and I nod to him. I climb into my bed, and I settle beneath the blankets, and I curl into myself. I wake up. There is gray light through the window. I squint to avoid it. The first thought I have is of my parents. I'm fucking pissed. I get out of bed, shower, shave, brush my teeth. The mirror, myself, my eyes, they are not a consideration today, not even close. As I get dressed, Miles walks in carrying two cups of coffee. He hands one of them to me. "I brought you a cup of coffee." "Thanks. You like it black, right?" "Yeah." I take a sip, set the mug on the nightstand next to my bed, continue dressing. Miles walks to his bed and he sits down and he speaks. "I appreciate you allowing me to have the room yesterday." "Don't mention it. I was grappling with some things." "You all right now?"
"I'm better."
There is dense silence. A moment. Miles looks down at the floor, back at me.
"It was shame, James."
"What?"
"I am dealing with feelings of great shame, James. That's why I was in here all day yesterday. It was shame." "You ever need someone to talk about it, I'll do my best."
"Thank you, James. I know you will."
I finish dressing, sit down on my bed. Miles is staring at the floor.
"You okay?"
He nods. He does not look okay. I stand, walk over to him, sit down on his bed, put my arms around him, hug him. He hugs me back, strong, and I can feel the shame coming through his arms. I am a criminal, and he is a judge, and I am white, and he is black, but at this moment, none of that matters. He is a man who needs a friend, and I can be his friend. I wait for him to release me, wait for him to get rid of whatever it is, and after a couple of long minutes, he does. I stand, and I speak. "You need anything, come find me. I'm not good for much, but I'll do my best." He nods.
"Thank you, James."
I walk out of the room and into the hall, and the hall brings back my anger. Anger because my parents are here. Anger because I don't want to see them. I walk into the unit, and I go to do the coffee, but the coffee has been done. I look at the job board. The space next to my name reads Family. I leave the unit, and I walk to the dining hall. I get a tray, a plate, a breakfast burrito. I sit down at an empty table. I'm angry and I want to be alone. I eat quickly. The burrito is stuffed with eggs, bacon, cheese, and small clumps of unidentifiable vegetables. It is disgusting, but I eat it anyway. I'd like to eat 100 of them. The anger is becoming fury. The fury is rising. I finish eating and I leave, and I head toward the lecture hall. There are men ahead of me and men behind me. I pay them no mind. I just walk. Joanne is waiting for me at the door to the lecture hall. She asks me to come to her office. We walk through the halls side by side.
How are you today, James?
Fine.
You seem angry.
I am.
Why?
Because I am. We arrive at her office. We step inside. She sits in the chair. I sit on the couch.
Your parents arrived here early this morning. They've been settling in at the family center. We have a meeting with them in a few minutes.
Great.
You're not happy about this, are you?
No.
Why?
Because I don't want to deal with them.
Why?
They make me angry.
Why?
I don't know why.
There must be specific reasons.
Whatever reasons there are, they're bullshit. Things like them hassling me or being worried about me. Stupid shit that I've always deserved.
Do you think your feelings have any real validity?
I don't know.
How long have you had them?
I've been pissed at my parents for as long as I can remember.
Maybe we can figure out why that is while they're here.
I doubt it.
Keep in mind that they're here because they love you and want to help you. This is not an easy thing for them. I'll try.
We usually start by sitting everyone down in a room. If your parents are going to understand where you are and what they can do to help you, they need to know what you've been doing and to what extent you've been doing it. We would like you to tell them. That's going to be a fucking nightmare.
Why do you think that?
My parents know I drink too much, and they know I do drugs, but they have no idea how much, and they don't know anything about my legal problems.
How do they not know?
I never told them.
Do you think they're going to react poorly?
I laugh. Poorly doesn't describe how I think they're going to react.
Whatever their reaction is, we'll deal with it. That's why they're here. That's why we're here.
I guess.
I think you're going to be surprised.
I highly fucking doubt it. She looks at her watch.
We should go.
She stands. I stand. Okay. She opens the door and we leave her office and we start walking through the halls. They are bright and they make me angry. With each step I get more and more angry. I don't want to see my parents. I don't want to be in the same room with them. I don't want to speak to them. I don't want them to speak to me. This is how I've always felt. They're my parents. I don't want them anywhere near me. My hands start shaking and my heart starts beating like a cannon on a field of war. Joanne senses this and she takes my hand, the hand closest to her, and she holds it and she smiles. I try to smile back, but I can't smile. The fury is rising. I don't want to see my parents. We arrive at a door. Joanne knocks, and a voice says, "Come in." She looks at me, and she squeezes my hand tight. I stare at the ground. I'm shaking, and my heart. I look up, and I take a deep breath, and I nod. Joanne opens the door. We step inside. My mother and my father are sitting at a conference table on the opposite side of the room. I'm shaking. They're with a completely bald man in his 30s, who is wearing a black sweater and black jeans. My heart. As he turns to look at me, my mother stands. She is wearing khakis and a white shirt and a blue blazer and a silk paisley scarf, and her hair is perfect, and her makeup is perfect, and there are diamonds on her fingers, and there are diamonds in her ears. She rushes toward me. The fury is rising. I want to get the fuck out of here. I want out.
James.
She hugs me. I don't like it when she touches me, and I don't hug her back. She lets me go, but she keeps her hands on my shoulders.
You look great.
I want her hands gone.
You're gaining weight.
Her eyes away.
And your face and teeth are better. You look so much better.
She hugs me again. I want her away. Get the fuck away.
Oh, James.
She lets go of me, stares. My father steps forward. Khakis, blue Oxford, blue blazer, a large, expensive watch. He hugs me. I want him away. How are you, James? He lets me go. I'm fine. You look much better. I guess so. Joanne steps forward.
Mr. Fry.
She reaches to shake his hand. He takes it. Call me Bob.
Joanne nods. Bob, I'm Joanne. I'm a psychologist who has been working with your son.
Dad smiles. He looks better.
Joanne smiles. He is better, and he's on the road toward getting much better.
Dad smiles. We're very proud of him for coming here.
Joanne smiles. You should be.
He nods, looks at me. I look away. Joanne speaks.
Why don't we sit? Get started.
My mother smiles, and she nods. My father says, okay. They take their seats, the same seats. I sit on the far side of the table as far away as possible. I hold my hands in my lap. They are shaking. I stare straight ahead, stare at the surface of a bright white wall. Joanne sits between us, looks at the man in black, and nods. The man speaks.
Hi, James. My name is Daniel, and I'm a counselor at the family center.
I stare at the wall.
I'm going to be working with you and your parents while they're here.
My hands are shaking.
As I believe you know, we like to start our work in the family program by having the individual with chemical dependency issues talk to the family members about their habits and their use.
My heart, my heart, my heart. Like a cannon on a field of war.
We'd like you to be as honest as possible, and you should take as much time as you need.
I nod.
Start whenever you'd like.
I look straight across the table. My mother and father are waiting for me. Before I start, I just want to say that I don't want to do this, and I wish you hadn't come here, and I'm sorry you have to hear what I'm about to tell you.
My father nods, and he squeezes my mother's hand.
I've been drinking for as long as I can remember. As a young kid, I used to steal sips from beers at football games we went to together and drink leftover glasses of wine at your dinner parties. I don't know why I did it. I just did. It made me feel better about myself for some reason, and I liked it. Liked it more than anything I had ever experienced. I did it as much and as often as I could, which was fairly often. We went to a lot of football games, and you guys had a lot of parties. I got drunk for the first time when I was 10. You were out at the symphony or at some charity function, and I snuck out of the house without the babysitter knowing, and I went down the street to a party some high school kids were having. They thought it was cool that I was there, and they fed me drinks till I threw up. I stumbled home, and the babysitter was asleep, and I went to bed. My mother wipes her eyes. My father squeezes her hand. I smoked pot for the first time at 12. Same thing. I snuck out to a party, and the older kids gave it to me. I didn't like it much, but I liked that they thought I was cool. I did it as much as I could, and because you guys were out or away a lot, it was easy to do. The babysitters never gave two shits, and sometimes they did it with me. My mother holds a hand to her face. My father looks down at the table. I blacked out for the first time at 14. I was drinking and smoking in the basement of someone's house, and the next thing I knew, it was morning and I was home. By then, I was getting fucked up 3 or 4 times a week. At 15, I started using harder stuff, coke and acid, and crystal meth. I liked all of them more than pot, so I stopped smoking it, and it's the only drug I've ever quit using. I was also selling drugs and liquor at 15. I'd go into the ghetto over in the harbor and meet up with this guy named Freddy. He was a low-level dealer, and if I gave him a couple bucks, he'd get me whatever I wanted. People knew I could get shit, so they gave me rides. The deal was they had to buy me something, too. When I couldn't get rides, I took your car. When I didn't have money, Freddy gave me credit. He liked me and called me White Boy James, and I became known over there as that. It was fucking stupid and dangerous, but I liked it, thought it was cool, and it allowed me to get anything I wanted whenever I wanted it. I wanted it all the time. My mother starts crying. My father stares at me. 16 and 17 were more of the same. I bought and sold liquor and drugs, did as much as I could of whatever I could get. I got fucked up before school, during school, after school. I got fucked up every single day. I drank and mostly used meth. And when I had that overdose, that's what it was, meth and alcohol. I don't know how much I did because I was blacked out. You never knew what went wrong because I refused to talk to the doctors. I know you're sitting there thinking you should have known more, and you should have stopped me, but I hid things well, and you tried. You tried hard. If you remember, you threatened me with rehab a bunch of times, and I told you if you sent me, I'd walk out and you'd never see or hear from me again. At the time, I would have done it. There was nothing you could have done to change me. I wouldn't have stopped. I take a deep breath. My mother has moved closer to my father and is sobbing into her own hands. I can see her makeup streaking through her fingers. My father is staring at me, and his eyes are wet. I have never seen him cry before, never seen him even close. 18, same thing, but more. Went away to school in the fall. No rules, you weren't around. I got a monthly allowance. I was in heaven. I blacked out every night. Always had a bloody nose from snorting coke all the time. Pissed in my bed 3 or 4 times a week because I was too drunk to get out of bed. 19, same thing, but probably worse. At 20, I started smoking coke. I used all the money you gave me to buy it and sell it. The FBI started investigating me for dealing, and I got questioned by them at the local police station 5 or 6 times. They never got me on anything. 21, bad year. I started smoking crack, which I loved. I smoked it as much as I could, which was basically every day. Crack is a bad drug, and it fucked me up. I was throwing up blood, pissing blood, shitting blood. I was sick all the time. I don't really know how I managed it, but I finished school, and you guys got me that job and sent me to Europe. I know you did it because you thought it would be good for me to have a job and good for me to be away, but it wasn't. I didn't really have to work, and I spent all of my time getting hammered and getting in trouble. There was no crack over there, but there was freebase, and there was powder. And I did a lot of both of them. Mother sobs in her hands. Tears run down father's cheeks. He does not wipe them. Just stares at me. While I was there, I came back to see my girlfriend from college. I know you remember her because you liked her so much. And you had hoped things would work out between us. We had broken up at the end of school and had then reconciled through letters and the phone. And she was planning on coming over and living with me. I was excited about it, and I sort of thought of it as a last chance at redeeming myself. I knew if she came over, I would have to straighten up because she was sick of dealing with my shit. I was hopeful, and it was good, and I was so excited that I broke one of my rules, which was never call her when I was drunk. 3 nights in a row I called, and I don't know what I said because I was blacked out. When I called again on the 4th day, her mom answered and told me never to call again, that she didn't ever want to have anything to do with me. I freaked out and went on a nasty bender and then decided I would come back to the States because I knew she was planning to visit school to see some friends. I can't look at my parents anymore, so I look at the table. I flew from Paris to Chicago, drove from Chicago to Ohio. When I got there, I stayed sober until I found her, and when I found her, she wouldn't talk to me. She told me to go away, that she never wanted to see me, speak to me, or have anything to do with me ever again. I was crushed. I went out and I drank as much as I could and smoked as much crack as I could, and when I was good and loaded, I decided to go find her and try to talk to her again. I went to a bar where we used to hang out and where I knew she'd be. As I was driving up, I saw her standing out front with a few of her friends. I was staring at her and not paying attention to the road, and I drove up onto a sidewalk and hit a cop who was standing there. I didn't hit him hard because I was only going about 5 miles an hour, but I hit him. She saw me do it, and a whole bunch of other people saw me do it. The cop called for backup, and I sat in the car and stared at her and waited. The backup came, and they approached the car and asked me to get out, and I said, "You want me out? Then get me out, you fucking pigs." They opened the door, I started swinging, and they beat my ass with billy clubs and arrested me. As they hauled me away, kicking and screaming, I tried to get the crowd to attack them and free me, which didn't happen. When I was sitting in the back of the cruiser, she walked up and looked at me, and she was crying, and I asked if she'd come bail me out, and she nodded and said, "Yes, I'll come." I stayed in jail that night, and I was arraigned the next morning on charges of assault with a deadly weapon, assaulting an officer of the law, felony DUI, disturbing the peace, resisting arrest, driving without a license, driving without insurance, attempted incitement of a riot, possession of a narcotic with intent to distribute, and felony mayhem. The only thing that was bullshit was the narc charge, and that was bullshit because I intended to use it, not distribute it. She didn't show up, so a buddy of mine paid my bail on a credit card, and I flew back to Paris. As far as I know, I am still wanted on all of the charges. I look up. My parents are both silent, and they are both crying. Tears are running down their faces, and my mother's breathing is labored. She breaks down, and she starts sobbing. I wait for her to stop, but she doesn't. She just sobs, sobs, sobs. My father puts his arms around her, and he whispers in her ear, quietly whispers, but it doesn't do any good. My mother sobs. I watch her, and I wait for her to stop. It takes a lifetime. A fucking lifetime. When she is quiet, I speak again. I stayed in Paris, got fucked up, knew I was killing myself, and I didn't care. From there I went to London and did the same thing. When I came back to the States and I went down to North Carolina, I started smoking crack again. Crack is an evil and dangerous drug, and I smoked as much of it as I could get. I also drank as much as I could drink, which at that point was quite a bit. I don't remember much of what I did down there because I was so fucked up all the time, but I know I got arrested again. I also know I got arrested in Michigan, though I have no idea what I was doing in Michigan. I skipped bail in both places, so I guess I'm wanted there as well. For the last 6 months, I've just been drinking and smoking and waiting to die. My mother is sobbing and my father is holding her. I don't wait for her this time. I just want this to end. I don't blame you for this, and I don't think there's anything you could have done to stop it. I am what I am, which is an alcoholic and a drug addict and a criminal. And I am what I am because I made myself so. You did the best you could with me, and you loved me the best you could, and that's all I could have ever asked for from you. I have no excuses for what I've done, or for who I am, or for what I've put you through all these years. My mother starts sobbing, louder than before, and more wrenching. Her makeup is smeared all over her hands and her face and her clothes, and she is having trouble breathing. She clings to my father, who holds her and stares at the floor. Tears are running from his cheeks and dripping onto his pants. I can see that his lips are quivering. He shakes his head and he starts to look up at me, but he can't do it. I sit and watch them. The fury is in me and has risen. It is peaking. I don't understand why this happens, but every time I'm near them, it does happen. They try to love me. I hurt them. They try to be decent and reasonable. I won't be decent or reasonable. They try to help me. I resent them for it. I don't understand why. They are my parents. They are doing the best they can do. This is how it has always been with me. Give me something good, I'll destroy it. Love me, I'll destroy you. I have never felt deserving of anything in my life. I have never felt as if I were worth the diseased space I occupy. This feeling has inhabited everything I've ever done, seen, or had anything to do with, and it has infected every relationship I have ever had with everyone I've ever known. I don't understand it. I don't understand why it's here. I hate it as I hate myself, and for whatever the reason, my parents' presence has always made it worse. They are only trying to love me, but they have always made it fucking worse. Joanne stands, and she walks over to me, and she leans to my ear. I think we should go. I look at my parents. They are still crying. There are tears dripping from my father's face, and my mother is having trouble breathing. I would like to do something to make them feel better, but I'm incapable of it. I hate myself too much to do anything. I stand and walk out of the room. Joanne is holding the door open, and she closes it behind me. As soon as it is shut and as soon as I can no longer see, hear, feel, touch, or hurt my parents, I start to feel better. We start walking. Joanne doesn't speak, and neither do I. We just walk through the halls. I think about my parents sitting in that room crying because of me, and we head toward Joanne's office. When we arrive, she opens the door. We walk inside, and I sit down on the couch, and she sits across from me. How do you feel?
Suicide.
What? It's the only word that fits.
You feel like killing yourself?
I won't, but at this moment it seems like a reasonable option.
Why?
They're my parents. When I'm near them, I get so angry that I can't control myself. That anger makes me hate myself more than I already do, and that makes suicide seem like a reasonable option.
Do you need supervision?
No, I'm too much of a pansy to actually do it.
You think suicide is an act of bravery?
No, I think it's cowardly, just like I think addiction is cowardly, but I do think that they both require a certain kind of pathetic strength.
Strength?
You have to be fairly strong to feel anything as powerful as hatred or self-hatred. Addiction and suicide are not for the weak.
I think that's ridiculous.
Ridiculous things can be true.
Why do your parents make you so angry?
I don't know.
Did you experience abuse as a child?
Not that I remember.
Do you think it's possible?
No.
Why?
I grew up in a safe, sheltered environment. My parents have always loved me, and they've always tried to protect me, and they've always tried to do their best by me. They fucking piss me off, but there is no way they ever abused me.
What about someone else?
No.
Are you sure?
Yes. I pull a cigarette from my pocket, light it, take a drag. The nicotine slows my heart and calms me.
What next?
Lunch. And after that, you go down to the family center. You'll spend the afternoon in group sessions with the members of other people's families until dinner. After dinner, we'll sit down with your parents again.
Why?
To discuss this morning.
That'll be fun.
You were brave this morning. You were very honest and very straightforward, and you said a lot of things that probably weren't easy to say. Your parents reacted in a very normal, natural way, and if they hadn't reacted that way, I would be worried about our ability to make progress with them. Now that they know what they need to know, we can work on healing your wounds and figuring out how you can get along better.
When will we be done tonight?
Depends on what we get into with your parents.
Give me an estimate.
You trying to meet up with Lily?
What?
You heard me.
Yeah.
I'm trying to meet up with Lily.
Don't.
Why?
If you get caught, you'll be in serious trouble.
Sounds like I got caught already.
There is an idea that there is something going on. We have not caught you.
Where'd you get the idea?
I can't discuss that with you.
You want me to discuss things with you, but you won't discuss things with me. That's fucking bullshit, Joanne.
You think so?
Yeah, I do. You be straight with me, I'll be straight with you. That's the fucking deal. If it's not, you can go fuck yourself.
I'm not your enemy.
You are if you're not straight with me.
Lily is very smitten with you. One of the counselors on her unit overheard her talking to one of her girlfriends about you. She has since heard Lily talking about you a number of other times. It seems that you're all that Lily wants to talk about.
I smile.
Why are you smiling?
I like that she's smitten with me.
It's a bad idea, James.
Why?
You should be concentrating on what you're here for, which is getting sober and rebuilding your life. Lily is a distraction that takes you away from that. Both of you are very fragile and vulnerable right now, and if something went wrong between the two of you, it would jeopardize your sobriety.
I can handle it.
Overconfidence kills a lot of people.
She makes me feel good, better than I feel with anyone else.
I'm sure she does, but that doesn't change our policy.
I don't want to let her go.
It's in the best interests of both of you.
I'll take your advice under consideration.
Take it further than that.
I stand.
I'm going to eat.
She nods.
I'll see you tonight.
I turn, and I open her door, and I walk out of Joanne's office. I go to the dining hall. As I walk down the glass corridor separating the men from the women, I see Lily sitting at a table. She is staring at me, and I stare back, though I make no other sort of acknowledgement. It is hard to stare at her, hard because she's not the distant girl who smiles at me anymore. She has become more than that, more than I expected her to become, and more than I was looking for her to become. She is becoming what I wanted, she the last, with the arctic eyes to become, which is someone who loves me, simply and truly, and as I am. It is hard to stare at her, because as I know she is starting to love me, I am starting to love her. I don't care what she's done or who she's done it with. I don't care about whatever demons may be in her closet. I care about how she makes me feel, and she makes me feel strong and safe and calm and warm and true. It is hard to stare because I am forced to contemplate giving it up. It is hard to stare, but I do it anyway. I get a tray and I get in line, and I get a plate of tuna noodle casserole. I ask for 10, but the lady in the hairnet says no. I go to the salad bar, and I get 5 plates. I put lettuce on one, cottage cheese on another, beets on the third, niblets of corn on the fourth, croutons on the fifth. My tray is full, so I get another tray. I put 4 plates on it, each piled high with portions of pudding, peaches, slices of apple pie, and carrot cake. I walk slowly through the dining area, carrying both trays. They're heavy, and I hear a couple of snickers, and I hear a couple of laughs. A voice I don't know says that's a sad addiction. I chuckle. I find my friends Ed and Ted and Leonard and Maddie and Miles, and I sit down with them. Leonard speaks. Where you been all day? My parents are here. Miles speaks. Are they here for the family program? Yeah. How has it been? Shitty. Why? I had to do this confession thing this morning where I told them about all the bad shit I've done. Ed speaks. What didn't they know about? They didn't know much. What was the worst? The crack, and the fact that I'm wanted in 3 states. Leonard speaks. What are you wanted for? A bunch of shit. Miles speaks. Do you have warrants out against you, James? Yes. Where? Michigan, Ohio, and North Carolina. Are you doing anything to take care of them? Somebody here is trying to do something. Ted speaks. When I told my mama I smoked the rock, she asked if I could get her some. Everyone laughs. She did. She said, I've been hearing all about this crack stuff, and I want to try me some. I got a 50 bag, and I smoked with her till her eyes were in the back of her head. She didn't want no more after that. Everyone laughs again, though the image of Ted's mama with her eyes in the back of her head is not a funny one. We spend the rest of lunch laughing more, mostly at Maddie, who is still struggling to stop swearing. Every third or fourth word he speaks is either goddamn or fuck and is immediately followed by a string of other curses, which are directed at himself. Eventually, he just stops speaking entirely. By the time lunch is over, the men have devoured the food on all of my plates. Everything is gone. As we stand to leave, I look across the dining hall and through the glass at Lily. She is smiling at me, and the smile hurts. I will not, could not, don't want to give that smile up. I won't give it up. No fucking way. We walk out of the dining hall. My friends head toward the lecture. I walk through halls into areas I don't know, following signs that lead me to the family center. I arrive at a door. A sign on the door says, Welcome home. I open it and I go inside. The white walls are whiter, the light bulbs brighter, the paintings hanging happier. They are filled with scenes of families on picnics in wide open fields of green and wildflowers. The members of the families in the paintings are smiling, eating French bread, cutting fruit, and playing backgammon. Variations of them are along all of the walls. I follow them, and they take me to a large open room. On one side of the room, the entire wall is glass, and it looks out upon the lake. There are chairs in the room, chairs everywhere.
large plush chairs that look comfortable in their happy patterned upholstery. There are people sitting in the chairs. They are talking, smoking, drinking coffee, and waiting. Waiting for their family members and waiting to get better. It is easy to tell who is here as part of the family program and who is here as part of their own program. The family program people wear cleaner clothes, have better haircuts, nicer watches, sparkling jewelry. Their skin is more flush, their bodies glow. They have flesh on their bones. They have life in their eyes. The rest of us smoke cigarettes and drink cups of coffee. Our hands shake and we have bags under our eyes. We move slowly, and the only thing alive in our eyes is dread. I look around the room. My parents are huddled in a corner, softly speaking to each other. They see me. I hold up one finger and my father nods at me, and I go to the coffee machine. I get a cup, black and steaming, and I walk toward them. They stand as I approach. They are smiling, and they have changed their clothes, though the clothes are more or less the same. My mother has redone her hair and her makeup, and it is perfect again, and my father's blazer is crisply pressed. I can see the effort behind their smiles, and with each step closer I want to turn and run. My father speaks. "How are you, James?"
"Been better. You?"
"I think we've been better, too."
There is silence, smiling. I wish the smiling would stop. My mother speaks.
"Do you want to sit with us?"
I nod. We sit. They are side by side. I am across from them. There is a table between us. It has an ashtray. I reach into my pocket for my cigarettes and I take them out. My mother frowns.
"Could you not smoke, please?"
"Why?"
"Because I just changed my clothes and I don't want them to smell."
"Fine." I put the cigarettes back into my pocket. My mother watches me.
"Are you going to quit those things while you're here?"
"No."
"Why?"
"Because I don't want to quit these things."
"Why not?"
"I'll give you a choice, Mom. I can either smoke cigarettes or smoke crack. You make the call." She recoils, obviously hurt. I knew it would happen, but I did it anyway. My father speaks.
"I don't think you need to speak to your mother that way, James. Obviously, we'd rather have you smoke cigarettes than smoke crack."
"Then don't give me shit about it. Don't speak to us that way." I reach for my cup of coffee, and I drink it in one gulp. It's hot and steaming, and it burns my mouth, but I don't care. I pull the cup away and I speak. "I'm going to get some more coffee. You want some?" My father looks at my mother. My mother shakes her head no, and her expression tells me she's still hurt. My father looks back at me.
"I think we're fine."
I stand and I walk back to the coffee machine. As I fill my cup, a tall and thin man dressed like my father rings a bell hanging near the door. Everyone turns toward him. He tells us that we're going to split into groups, and that the groups will meet in separate rooms. He points to a pair of doors against the wall opposite the glass wall, and he starts reading names. When people hear their names called, they stand and they go through the doors. As I walk back to the corner where my parents are sitting, the man says my name. I continue toward my parents, and when I reach them, I speak.
"Looks like I've got to go."
My father nods. My mother looks like she's going to cry. I turn, and I start to walk away. My father speaks.
"James?"
I turn around.
"We're sorry about the smoking remarks."
My mother nods. Tears start running down her cheeks.
"We know you've got a lot that you're trying to deal with right now, and we know you're doing the best you can, so if you need to, it's okay if you smoke around us."
I smile. This simple gesture breaks my heart.
"Thank you."
My father smiles, and beneath her tears, my mother smiles. Her smile makes me feel a little better.
"I'll see you tonight."
I turn and I walk to my door. I walk through it, and I enter another large room. It is white, bright, and cheery. There are inspirational pictures on the walls with phrases like, "Take it day by day," "Let go, and let God." "Easy does it." There is thick carpet on the floor, and there are folding chairs spread in a wide circle around the room. There are people sitting in the chairs. I find an empty chair without anybody on either side of it, and I sit down. I am alone for a moment, but then a pregnant woman sits on one side of me, and a gray-haired man sits on the other. The room fills up, and for every patient here there are about three family members. Everyone looks nervous. A woman walks in. She's in her 30s, wearing khakis and Birkenstocks, and wool socks and a corded sweater. She has brown hair, green eyes, and looks as if she could be a model. She sits in the only empty chair in the circle, and she smiles.
"Welcome to your first group session at the family program."
There are nods. A couple people say, "Thank you."
What we're going to do in this session is introduce ourselves and ask each other questions. Family members often ask those of us in recovery about what we do or why we do what we do or what it feels like to do it. Those of us in recovery often ask family members how our actions affect them or how they feel when they're dealing with us or why they deal with us in the ways they do or why they deal with us at all. You should feel free to ask whatever you want, as long as it's not intended to hurt someone's feelings. I'll start with the introductions. She smiles. My name is Sophie, and I'm an addict and an alcoholic.
Everyone says, "Hello, Sophie." The man sitting next to her smiles, speaks. I'm Tony, and I'm the husband of an alcoholic.
Everyone says, "Hello, Tony,"
and the introductions move around the room. Mother of a heroin addict, meth addict, wife of a crack addict, alcoholic, son and daughter of an alcoholic, Vicodin addict, pregnant wife of a crack addict. There are all types of relations, all types of addicts and alcoholics. After the introductions, the questions are supposed to start. At first, no one speaks. People stare at the floor, stare at their hands, stare at each other. There are awkward smiles and frustrated sighs. After a few moments, a man who identified himself as a meth addict asks how long this session is going to last. Everyone laughs. A woman who identified herself as the wife of an alcoholic asks the same thing. How long does this last? Sophie smiles and asks her if she's referring to addiction. The woman nods and says yes. Sophie says addiction lasts a lifetime. It lasts a lifetime. From there, the questions start to flow. How does it feel to be addicted to something? Horrible. Why does it feel that way? Because we know what we're doing to ourselves and what we're doing to you, and we can't stop doing it. What does it feel like when you want it? Need. Overwhelming need. Uncontrollable need. Unimaginable need. What does it feel like when you get it? Relief, followed by horror, followed by more need. Why can't you stop? I don't know. Why can't you stop? I don't know. Why can't you stop? I don't know. There are other simpler, more technical questions. What is crack and how do you use it? Crack is cocaine cooked with ethyl alcohol, gas, and baking powder. We smoke it with a pipe. Where do you buy heroin, and how much does it cost? You buy heroin from a dealer, and it is very expensive. What is meth, and how is it made? Meth is speed, and it is made by cooking asthma medicine called ephedrine, formaldehyde, sometimes gas or fertilizer, and baking powder. What does it do to you? Robs you of your heart, robs you of your soul, takes away the ability and the desire to eat and to sleep, robs you of your sanity. The addicts and alcoholics give straight, simple answers. We ask no questions. Unlike the family members, we already know the answers. We fuck up your lives. We ruin every single one of your days. We are your worst nightmare. You don't know what to do with us. You're at the end of your rope. You don't know what to do. You're at the end of your fucking rope. You don't know what to do. At the end of the session, Sophie asks everyone to join hands. An intimacy has developed, and we do so eagerly. She has us recite a poem that she calls the Serenity Prayer. She says a line, and we follow. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. She smiles, we smile, everyone smiles. When we finish saying the prayer, she has us do it again. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. She has us do it again and again. When she stands, everyone else stands. She tells us we're finished, and everyone starts hugging each other. There are hugs sealing the bonds, hugs healing the wounds, hugs in appreciation of knowledge and insight, shared hugs of understanding, and hugs of compassion extended. After the hugs, Sophie opens the door, and we file out smiling and laughing, and in better shape than when we entered. Everyone says goodbye, thank you, goodbye, thank you. The primary patients walk through the halls to the dining hall. We do so as a group. The men talk to the men, the women talk to the women. It is all small talk, meaningless bullshit like where you from, how long you been here, what's your drug of choice. The talk continues as we walk through the glass corridor, and we form a line. It continues as we get trays and food. The talk stops when it's time to decide where to sit. Nearly everyone seeks out an empty table. The rest of the patients have yet to arrive, so there are plenty from which to choose. I find a table where no one is anywhere near me, and I sit down. I eat slowly. I stare at my plate, move my fork toward it, scoop, move the fork toward my mouth. I chew. I don't pay attention to what I'm chewing, and after a few bites, it doesn't matter. Everything tastes the same. Fork to plate, fork to mouth, chew. Everything tastes the same. My plate is empty. The rest of the patients are arriving, and the dining hall is starting to fill up. I stand with my tray, and I put it on the conveyor, and I walk out. I go back to the unit, and I go to my room. I have some time to burn before I am meeting my parents. I should be prepared. As calm as I can be, in order to control the fury which I know will come. Lily makes me calm, but Lily is not here. Free air makes me calm. The little book, the Tao, makes me calm, and it is sitting near my bed. I sit down on my bed, and I open the book at random, and I start to read. 15. Be as careful as crossing frozen water. Alert as a warrior on enemy ground. Be as courteous as a guest, as fluid as a stream. Be as shapeable as a block of wood, as receptive as a glass. Don't seek and don't expect. Be patient and wait until your mud settles and your water is clear. Be patient and wait. Your mud will settle. Your water will be clear. 63. Act without doing. Work without effort. Think of the large as small and the many as few. Confront the difficult while it is easy. Accomplish the great one step at a time. Don't reach and you will find. If you run into trouble, throw yourself toward it. Don't cling to comfort and everything will be comfortable. 79. Failure is an opportunity. If you blame others, there is no end to blame. Fulfill your obligations. Correct your mistakes. Do what you need to do and step away. Demand nothing and give all. Demand nothing and give all. 24. Stand on your toes.